genius. When I remark that Edgerton's genius was incredibly destructive, Hughes matter-of-factly says, Da Vinci drew up a blueprint for the first landmine. There's plenty of blood on his hands, too. Edgerton's cell is 18 by 18, gray brick, with a single cot and a stainless steel commode. As the prisoner's marquee prisoner, he doesn't share his cell. The walls are festooned with charts and formulae and an oversized poster of Da Vinci's Vitruvian Man. Da Vinci came up with the idea for the landmine, I tell him by way of introduction. Did you know that? Of course, he tells me in the bristly manner that would be familiar to anyone who saw his televised trial. Up close, it is shocking just how unacademic Edgerton looks. He's big, tall, muscular, thick across the shoulders, which taper down to a trim waist. Twice during our interview, he will drop without any warning and pump out exactly 50 push-ups before returning to our conversation. He's got a Joe Namath quality. Broadway Joe, a few years past his prime, going a little to seed, but still possessed of the grace and quickness from his playing days. There are two concessions to this scientist stereotype. The first is his head. He prefers to keep it shaven. It is bulbous, venous, ovoid, vaguely alien in appearance. The second is his glasses, thick-lensed, black and boxy. The lenses are stuck with an accretion of grit and eye crust. It's as though Edgerton can't be bothered to wipe them. His chilly green eyes seem to be staring at me through a grease-streaked window. Those eyes, they are not normal eyes. They seem to stare through me as though I were glass, focusing on the dead brick behind me. Do you know anything about Asian killer wasps? He asks abruptly. The Asian killer wasp is the only insect on Earth that kills for fun. They're just gigantic, a full 2 inches long. They love killing honeybees. They'll destroy entire colonies. Only takes a few minutes. They grab a bee and lop its head off with their giant mandibles, like popping the head off a dandelion. It would be like a giant mutant running loose in a nursery stomping babies to death. No reason. They just enjoy doing it. I ask if wasps are as fascinating to him as worms. Oh, no, he says. Worms are much more interesting. Worms are indiscriminate, you see. They will eat anything from a hippopotamus to an aphid. They are the ultimate piggybackers. Invite one inside and it's there for good. They're nightmare house guests. Once they're in, you'll never get rid of them. They're one of the oldest species on Earth. Right after the crust cooled, there were worms swimming in the primordial soup. The first creature to flop out of a tide pool onto land had a worm inside of it, I guarantee you. He smiled vacantly. They say cockroaches will be the last things left on Earth after a nuclear holocaust. Don't believe it. The last thing on Earth will be a worm in the guts of those cockroaches, sucking them dry. He pauses as if to regroup. Our conversation has this tenor, elliptical, backtracking, dead-ending. They say dolphins and pigs are the only animals that fuck for fun, he tells me. Other than us, of course. Worms fuck themselves. They lay eggs in their own skin. Once a worm gets long enough, a segment detaches to become its own worm. They really are motherfuckers, pardon the pun. There's no joy in it for them at all. No satisfaction of creation, only endless self-creation. As Hughes said, Edgerton appears to feel no remorse for the events on Falstaff Island. If anything, his abstract theorizing on the fate of the boys of Troop 52 is deeply chilling. How would you rather die? He asks himself, from a chopping axe or a little blade, a tiny blade that makes the thinnest ribbon of a cut, only enough to draw a single bead of blood from the skin, but it cuts and cuts and cuts and cuts. It doesn't stop cutting. It takes days. It is relentless. It doesn't matter how big or strong or resourceful you are, sooner or later that tiny blade will shred right through you. And it's not one blade, but a million blades inside you, cutting their way out, replicating themselves, slicing and gashing and mincing you up, or slowly whittling you down like a scalpel taking delicate curls off a giant redwood. You'll get to see yourself change. It's that slow progression. You'll see your strength get sapped, see your body take on terrifying new parameters. Your mind will probably snap well before your body caves in. Personally, I'd take the axe. Ultimately, the question of whether or not Edgerton is insane becomes a moot point. He is a sociopath. It doesn't take a clinical degree to understand that. He is as remorseless and unthinking as his beloved worms. Do you want to know the best, most effective transmitter of contagion known to man? Edgerton asks me this with a pinprick of mad light dancing in each iris. It's love. Love is the absolute killer. Care, the milk of human kindness. People try so hard to save the people they love that they end up catching the contagion themselves. They give comfort, deliver aid, and in doing so they acquire the infection. Then those people are cared for by others and they get infected. On it goes. He shrugs. But that's people. People care too much. They love at all costs, and so they pay the ultimate price. Part 3. Contagion. Evidence log, case 518C, piece F44, personal effects. Preliminary advertising copy for Thestamax, internal document only, never published. Recovered from site F. Ariadne Advertising, 364 Bay Street, Toronto, Ontario, by Officer Stacy LaPierre, badge 992. Find your thinspiration. Thestamax. Enjoy rapid, sustained, pain-free weight loss, guaranteed. Not an appetite suppressant. Eat whatever you want, whenever you want, and shed those troublesome pounds. The two-pill solution. www.thestamax.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. Headache, flushing, stuffy or runny nose, or dizziness may occur. Vision changes such as increased sensitivity to light, blurred vision, or trouble telling blue and green colors apart may also occur. If any of these effects persist or worsen, or if you enjoy a sudden weight reduction that seems radical or unhealthy, contact your doctor immediately or visit the nearest hospital. Money back guaranteed. Chapter 34. Fires burning, draw nearer, in the gloaming, come sing and be merry. Shelley had moved back to the cabin where he curled up under the shattered bed frames. He'd heaped the soaked mattresses into a sloppy teepee and lay in the mildewy darkness, singing. Anyone within earshot would have noted his lovely voice. It hit each register purely. Kumbaya, my lord, kumbaya. Kumbaya, my lord, kumbaya. Kumbaya, my lord, kumbaya. O Lord, kumbaya. His voice dipped to a weak, warbling note. He went silent. His body tensed. He loosed a tortured moan, the sound of a sick animal. His hands rose to his face. His nails dug into the creases of his forehead. Slowly, he dragged them downwards. His ragged fingernails tore trenches through his flesh. Blood wept from the wounds, though not very much. The sluggish trickles stopped quickly, like spigots being shut off. In the silence, he could hear it. Them. A tight, slippery sound like a Vaseline-coated rope pulled through a tightened fist, coming from inside of him. Things had turned out very bad for Shelley. More than the other boys, Shelley was a realist. He understood how the world worked. Bad things happened to good people. Bad people died happy in their beds. It happened every day. So why bother being good? The word itself was attached to a series of behaviors that was, at best, an abstraction. A person profited nothing from being good. It wasn't as if Shelley had a choice. Ever since he could remember, he'd seen the world this way. People were things to be used, peeled back, opened up, roughly dissected, and dismissed. All creatures on Earth fell under the same cold scrutiny. The Boy in the Moon. That had been Shelley's nickname. He'd overheard the teachers calling him that one afternoon as he'd lingered around their lounge, although for a while it had been the Toucher. He'd earned this moniker for his behavior during recess, which he'd spent haunting the edges of the schoolyard, He watched the girls play. Sometimes he'd sidle up alongside one of them, Trudy Dennison was a favorite, and reach out his arm to gather up her long, soft hair, letting it fall tricklingly between his fingers. He did not find this arousing. Shelley was rarely aroused by anything. Girls did not excite him as they did most boys his age. Boys didn't excite Shelley either, not in the traditional manner, anyway. When girls felt Shelley's fingers passing through their hair, a look of teeming disgust came into their eyes. That disgust often shaded into an unease that held a gasping edge of fear, as if they were thinking that the world might be a better and safer place were he, Shelley Longpre, not a part of it. Shelley was aware of their revulsion, but it did not trouble him. He enjoyed it, actually, as much as he enjoyed anything at all. Last year, Trudy Dennison squealed on him. He had to sit down with the principal, Mr. Levesque. Shelley's father, a tire salesman, was also there, and his mother in her watered silk dress. Shelley had been sternly warned that touching anyone without that person's permission was bad. Shelley nodded and smiled his sullen, empty smile. On the way out of the office, he heard his father tell the principal, "It won't happen again. Shelley's just... he's slow." Nobody made too big a deal of it. Touching was just Shelley's thing, the way eating boogers was Neil Caruso's thing, or filching cigarettes behind the utility shed was Ephraim's thing, or playing pocket pool under the trampoline was Benjamin Rimmer's thing. Every boy had his thing, and on the grand spectrum, Shelley's wasn't so bad. It indicated a future badness, perhaps, a signpost, as that quack Dr. Harley might say, but right now it was harmless, if slightly troubling. His fellow scouts didn't give Shelley grief over it. For one, many of them probably wanted to touch Trudy Dennison's flowing honey-scented hair, too. They simply didn't take the next logical step. And two, the boys avoided picking on Shelley out of the sense, inexpressible yet tangible, that he might do something very wrong in retaliation. The worst they ever called Shelley was dumb. "A real dumb bunny," as Eve would say. Well, used to say, anyway. Shelley was happy as a person such as himself could be with this perception. Let everyone think he was dull. Let their eyes fall on his beanpole body and sluggish limbs and feel nothing but a vague revulsion that they were unable to properly account for. Revulsion mixed with an odd sense of disquiet. "Someone's laughing, my lord, kumbaya. Someone's laughing, my lord, kumbaya. Someone's laughing, my lord, kumbaya. Oh, lord, kumbaya." Without his being consciously aware of it, Shelley's mouth dipped to the raw pine floor. He gnawed on it. His teeth scritched on the wood. Splinters drove deep into his gums. Blood flowed. Shelley used to be the toucher. Now he was the touched, thanks to the twitchy, squirmy things inside him now, making a home. "Hear me crying and laughing, my lord, kumbaya," Shelley warbled. "Hear me crying, my lord, kumbaya. Hear me crying, my lord, kumbaya. Oh, lord, kumbaya." And Shelley had begun to cry. Tears squeezed from the sides of his eyes, but they ceased quickly. His body was dehydrated as a banana chip. Yesterday he'd urinated against the side of the cabin. What came out was just a thin dribble, clear as spring water. Not even the slightest yellow tinge. The yellow color was from the extra vitamins and minerals he usually pissed away. But now he understood the things inside of him were helping themselves to all that extra and more. The feeble light of the moon cast through the shattered roof, through the sodden mattresses making up Shelley's awful nest, falling upon his body. His trousers hung low, divulging half an inch of ass crack. His shirt was rucked up, the knobs of his spine were visible. Had anyone been watching, that person would have seen the flesh wringing Shelley's spine begin to lift. Something was tunneling its way through and up. Climbing the drain pipe of his spine, corkscrewing higher and higher. There came a series of dim pops, like weak firecrackers going off, trapped air popping between Shelley's vertebrae. The tunneling thing looped round the spine, tightening, burrowing through the lacework of tissue and muscle around again and again and again. Shelley did not scream, did not move. At one point, he did reach around and scratch at his back, as if under the belief that he'd been bitten by a mosquito. "Ugh," he said, a Neanderthal note. "Ugh, ugh, ugh." The tube threaded up his spine, between the sharp wings of Shelley's scapula. Upon reaching his neck, it thinned out, appearing to struggle. Then it flexed convulsively, fattening into a bulging cord up the nape of Shelley's neck, its scolex fat at his hairline. "Ugh," Shelley said breathlessly. His mouth opened. A clotted rope of blood jetted between his teeth. It entered his cranial vault. Shelley was immediately suffused with comforting warmth. He sighed, curling deeper into himself. He shut his eyes. Later that night, Shelley would awake from a familiar dream. They all shared the same palette, shifting browns and blacks and olive greens, half-formed shapes melting into one another, shivering and feverish with a hammer-hard erection teepeeing his shorts. A booming voice followed him out of his dreamscape. "Rock and roll, Shelley, my man. That's how it eats. That's the only way it eats." Chapter 35. Max and Newton rose with the drowsy half-light of dawn. The sun hummed over the sea, an orange sine wave radiating heat shimmers against the leavening dark. Max hadn't slept well. He'd kept sensing strange, vaguely menacing shapes darting at the edges of the fire's light. His skin was rubbed raw around his waist, which had shrunk somewhat over the past few days. He took a swig from his canteen and winced at the stale, iron-like taste of the water. He fingered his clothes, which he'd hung up last night. Dry enough. Newton got up soon afterward. They tugged on their pants and socks and boots in silence. They squinted across the sea into the new sun. The dark hulls of those strange ships dotted the water toward North Point. "We have to get Eef," Max said. "He may have gone back to camp," Newt said. "You think?" "We better check." They retraced their route, passing through a glade where the light hung in brilliant icicles and thousands of green silkworms hung from the tree branches. "Is this what they make silk shirts out of?" Newt said. "How do they even stay together? It'd be like trying to sew with spider's thread." The day was bright and warm, the air shot with dazzling light. A deep-seated fear picked along the edges of their thoughts. They were frightened, but that emotion rested with easy familiarity in their chests by now. They located yesterday's footsteps in the grass and followed them into the spruces and found Ephraim on the ground, surrounded by spiky smears of blood. "Eef, what?" Max said, unable to understand what he was seeing. When the carnival came to Charlottetown last year, Max and Ephraim had gone. Max's father had driven them and bought ride tickets for both boys, a nicety Ephraim's mother accepted with stoic gratefulness. They rode the zipper and had their spines delightfully rearranged on the Comet, an ancient wooden roller coaster operated by a carny with a spiderweb tattooed on his forehead. A tiny black spider descended to the tip of his nose on a strand so blue, so pale, you might mistake it for a vein. After gorging on waffle cones and funnel cake, they'd come across a freak show operating out of a small blue-and-white striped tent at the back of the fairground. Three tickets apiece granted them entry to a cramped, dark space smelling of horse manure and another scent beyond naming. The freaks took the stage to the slightly awed, mainly disgusted oohs of the hick crowd. "Freaks," Max remembered thinking. But why would they let themselves be called that? They weren't that freakish looking, tattooed and pierced, sure, but nothing that'd raise your eyebrow if you passed them on the street. But what the performers did to their bodies was truly freakish. One guy guided a power drill with a 6-inch bit deep into his septum, so deep the tip must have tickled the brainstem, then skewered a metal hook, a meat hook, same as plucked hens, hung in the butcher's window, through the hole, drawing the hook out through his mouth. Another guy chewed light bulbs and stuck long steel needles through his arms, skewering himself like a bug on a pin. Max was horrified, which he assumed was the sought-for reaction. Ephraim, however, was mesmerized. Max had seen that look before. Ephraim was the daredevil, after all. The boy who'd jumped his bike off the seawall, mistiming it badly and fracturing his leg. Max had sat with him in the ER afterward. Ephraim's leg hung at a crazy cockeyed angle. It hurt Max's eyes to look at it. Ephraim, however, was fascinated. "Check it out, Max," he kept saying, a weird smile on his face. "Check it out." As soon as the cast came off, Ephraim was back at the seawall for another try. His mom must have had a constant conniption fit, but Eve had always been that way. Max figured the crazy stunts must have bled away Eve's rage, the theory of displacement like he'd seen demonstrated in science class. Problem was, God gave you one body. What you did with it was your own business, but the truth, as Max saw it, was this. You throw your body at the world. The world hits back. The world wins. So you had to take great care of what God gave you. Eve had never gotten that message. When they rounded into the sunlit clearing, Max initially thought Ephraim had been murdered. Somebody or something had found him here all alone and set upon him in a fury. But then he saw the wounds, hacks and gouges, not stabs, and the Swiss Army knife still clutched in Ephraim's hands. He thought, how could anyone do this to himself? But he knew Ephraim very well. He knew him better than anyone else on earth, maybe. So he knew. The two boys hunched beside their troop mate. Newton touched Ephraim's chest, which rose and fell weakly. There were large, clumsy, gashing wounds in Ephraim's hand and leg. Blood was gummed in a 5-inch half-moon hacked into his side. The cut was jittery but progressively deeper, as if the person who'd done it had grown bolder after the blood started to flow. Worst of all was the long, twisting slash on his face. It began near his temple, where the bone sunk into a shallow divot and hacked straight down around his orbital bone, cleaving so deep through the skin of his cheek that the knife tip must have poked through into his mouth, then out again, tracing the line of his jaw before petering out in the middle of his chin. The trajectory alone was a brutal and terrifying thing to look at, a mark of madness. Newton was breathing hard, set to hyperventilate. Who did this?
He did it, Max said, near breathless. Eve did, to himself.
Why?
Ephraim's eyelids fluttered. He coughed weakly and said,
they're inside me, or maybe it's just one, but it's there. Sneaky.
Max gave Newton a helpless look.
There's nothing inside you, Eve.
Wrong.
Eve's breath stunk like sun-spoiled liver.
I've seen it. It's...
He licked his lips. Horrifyingly, Max could see the root of his tongue moving through the slit in his cheek.
It's smart. It lets me see just enough, even touch it before it slips away. But if I make enough holes, guess what? Nowhere for it to hide.
The mad certainty in his voice iced the sweat up Max's spine. His eyes fell upon the walkie-talkie. Its plastic casing was slicked with blood. He looked back at Ephraim, who'd followed the movement of his eyes and now turned away, refusing to meet Max's gaze. His eyes swarmed with an emotion Max couldn't intuit, a mixture of grief and shame and something else, something much darker.
"Who were you talking to?"
Max said. When Ephraim didn't answer, Max said, "You're not any skinnier. You look the same, Eve."
Mostly the same, he thought queasily.
Fact was, Ephraim appeared more or less the same as he had when the boat first dropped them off. He'd lost a few pounds, but so had Newton and Max.
"It's inside of me," Ephraim said.
Newt said, "How do you know for sure?"
A little birdie told me, okay?
Ephraim spat pure red. I know. There was a tone of stage 5 acceptance in Ephraim's voice. He could have been telling them he had inoperable brain cancer. Max figured it wasn't worth fighting. As his father said, you can't argue with someone who's already made up his mind. He exchanged a knowing look with Newton. A silent pact was settled upon. If this was what Eve believed, that he had a worm inside of him, okay, they'd accept it for now. Anything to stop him from cutting himself. Newton rummaged the first aid kit from his pack, swabs of peroxide and iodine no bigger than the sandy cloth wipes you get after a messy meal, butterfly bandages, a spool of gauze no bigger than a roll of quarters. Pitiful, really, when facing bodily devastation like this. Max attempted to paste a bandage over the gash in Ephraim's cheek. Eve screamed, a shocked bleat, so loud that Max's hands fled from his face. What do you want, Eve? Ephraim fixed Max with a pleading look. Get it out of me. How? Newt, you've got a better knife than mine. It's burrowed deep. It'll take a longer blade.
Newton covered his mouth with his hand. He couldn't imagine hacking into Eve in search of something he knew he'd never find, not after the turtle. Not ever, at all.
I can't do that, Eve. Pussy!
Ephraim spat the word out like poison.
Max, your dad cuts people, right? You helped the Scoutmaster. You could do it.
The best tactic was the one that stopped Ephraim from doing more damage to himself, Max figured. He'd tell him anything he wanted to hear.
I can do it, Eve, but not here. We need a cleaner site. You could get infected. I already am infected.
Yeah, but if I cut really deep and get it, we'll still need to patch you up. There's a medical kit back at camp.
I found some mushrooms, too, said Newt. They should make you throw up and poop your pants. Maybe we can get it out without having to cut.
Ephraim closed one eye as if he were squinting through a telescope.
You think?
Max slipped Ephraim's Swiss Army knife into his pocket. We get you back to camp and try the mushrooms. If that doesn't work, I'll use the knife. Deal? Ephraim squeezed his eyes shut. Long, thick veins pulsed at his temples.
My God, Max thought. They really do look like worms.
Chapter 36 They returned to camp to find Kent gone. It had taken nearly 3 hours to half-carry, half-drag Ephraim back. His wounds kept tearing apart and bleeding. The rusty smell of blood clung to their clothes. Could he infect them that way? Only if he was infected, which both Max and Newton couldn't quite believe. By the time they got back, ashy afternoon light was already hanging between the trees. They laid Ephraim on the picnic table by the cabin. Newton went round to check on Kent. The cellar doors were flung open.
Kent?
Newton called down.
Kent!
He inspected the doors. They didn't look to have been busted open. Maybe the stick Ephraim jammed between the handles had snapped or rattled free in the wind, which could mean that Kent had escaped. He could be out there in the woods. And no sign of Shelley, either. A fact that was not a concern because it was a relief not to have him around, yet deeply concerning, seeing as neither boy wanted to contemplate what Shelley might get up to out of sight.
You see Shell?
Newton asked Max back at the picnic table. Max shook his head.
You think something happened? Something must have happened, right?
Mercifully, Ephraim had passed out. Blood loss, shock. They left him temporarily, unease gripping their postures. The boys walked with a slight stoop, shoulders hunched against a phantom breeze as they made their way down to the shore.
What if Kent's gone?
Newton said quietly.
Gone where, Newt? What do you mean?
In truth, Newton didn't know. A shape sat in the dead center of his mind, only a notion, really. Its outline was nebulous, but he could make out its heart, a dark and sinister silhouette within the larger blackness that winked and writhed and wanted to play.
Do you think he might have tried to swim back?
Max kicked a pebble. He'd be crazy to try. That doesn't mean I can't picture him doing it.
Do
Do you think he'd make it? If he'd actually done it, Max was sure Kent was dead by now. The water was freezing, the undertow deadly, plus he had a strong suspicion Kent might not be welcomed with open arms even if he managed to reach shore. Max put Kent out of his mind for now. A merciless strain of expediency had settled over his thoughts. Ephraim needed help and was right here to receive it. Kent was gone and therefore beyond immediate help. Max wondered how he and Newton had managed to stay sane these last few days. This thought arrowed out of the clear blue. They were still okay, seeing what they'd seen, where Ephraim and Kent and Scoutmaster Tim and maybe Shelley had cracked. He couldn't say why that was, exactly. It wasn't that he didn't feel the same fear. Human beings couldn't function in a state of perfect, ongoing terror, could they? Their bodies would seize like a car with sugar in its gas tank, minds fusing shut as paralysis leached into their bones. Constant, unending terror warped minds, brains thinned and went brittle and then snapped. That's exactly how Max pictured it, a singing snap, like an icicle coming off a February Eve's trough. It could happen to anyone. It had happened to Eve, hadn't it? But everyone's built to different tolerances, and you didn't know your breaking point until the instant you hit it. How had Max kept that crushing fear at bay? He didn't really know. Maybe that was the trick. Maybe it was that he'd found a way to bleed it away in the quiet moments, breathing deep, feeling it slipping from him in almost imperceptible degrees. Maybe Newton had his own strategies, or maybe it wasn't anything you could strategize. It came down to that flexibility of a person's mind, an ability to withstand horrors and snap back like a fresh elastic band. A flinty mind shattered. In this way, he was glad not to be an adult. A grown-up's mind, even one belonging to a decent man like Scoutmaster Tim, lacked that elasticity. The world had been robbed of all its mysteries, and with those mysteries went the horror. Adults didn't believe in old wives' tales. You didn't see adults stepping over sidewalk cracks out of the fear that they might somehow, some way, break their mother's backs. They didn't wish on stars, not with the squinty-eyed fierceness of kids, anyway. You'll never find an adult who believes that saying Bloody Mary 3 times in front of a mirror in a dark room will summon a dark, blood-hungry entity. Adults were scared of different things, their jobs, their mortgages, whether they hung out with the right people, whether they would die unloved. These were pallid compared with the fears of a child, leering clowns under the bed and sliming monsters capering beyond the basement's light and faceless sucking horrors from beyond the stars. There's no 12-step or self-help group for dealing with those fears. Or maybe there is. You just grow up. And when you do, you surrender the nimbleness of mind required to believe in such things, but also to cope with them. And so when adults find themselves in a situation that nimbleness is needed, well, they can't summon it. So they fall to pieces, go insane, panic, suffer heart attacks and aneurysms brought on by fright. Why? They simply don't believe it could be happening. That's what's different about kids. They believe everything can happen and fully expect it to. Max knew he was at that age where disbelief began to set in. The erosion was constant. Santa Claus had gone first, then the monster in the closet. Soon he'd believe the way his folks did, rationally. But for now, he still believed enough, and maybe that had kept him sane. He was idly working all this over in his mind when the screams started. From the sworn testimony of Nathan Erickson, given before the Federal Investigatory Board in connection with the events occurring on Falstaff Island, Prince Edward Island. Question. Please clarify something for the court, Dr. Erickson. So far as you were aware, you and Dr. Edgerton were working on a diet pill? Answer. What do you mean? Question. I'm asking specifically about the grant Dr. Edgerton received. Answer. From the pharmaceutical concern, yes. Question. And it was the only funding the Edgerton lab was receiving? Answer. Yes? Question. No. Answer. Excuse me? Question. No, it wasn't the only funding the lab was receiving, Dr. Erickson. Answer. I'm sorry, what? Question. Dr. Erickson, for someone who claimed to have a higher IQ than most everyone assembled at this hearing today, is it possible that you were unaware of the end goal of the very experiments you were administering? Answer. Of course I know. I told you. A diet pill. Question. Dr. Erickson, I'd like to show you something. Dr. Erickson is handed a piece of paper. Question. Can you tell me what that is? Answer. It's a bank statement. Question. It's Dr. Edgerton's bank statement, for the account that administers the operating costs of his lab. Answer. Yes, all right. Question. Now, if you scan down, you will see the deposits made by the pharmaceutical company. Answer. They're here, yes. Question. Now, can you see the other single deposit, the one made on January 2nd? Answer. Yes. Question. Can you tell me how much that one is for? Answer. $3 million. Question. Exactly? Answer. $3,050,500.42. Question. Can you tell me who made the deposit? Answer. Is this a spelling test now? T.N.O. Prince Moritz. Question. Do you know what that company does, Dr. Erickson? Answer. I have no idea. Question. They are a military research firm. Answer. Okay. Question. 3 years ago, they were subjected to a grand jury investigation. The company was indicted on charges of industrial espionage and selling goods to foreign despots for the purposes of cementing various puppet regimes. Answer. I don't keep up on any of that. Question. As a company, they do not have the cleanest of hands. Answer. If you say so. Question. Dr. Erickson, may I ask you this? If Dr. Edgerton is the genius you claim he is, why couldn't he keep the worms where they belonged, in a subject's intestinal tract? Answer. As I said, even worms are complex organisms, terribly complex. Question. But, and please forgive my ignorance, isn't it the baseline nature of most tapeworms to remain in the gut? Answer. Generally so, yes. Question. Dr. Erickson, I will cut to the chase. Were you aware that Dr. Edgerton was in fact receiving competing grants, one from a biopharmaceutical company and the other from a military research firm? One of those companies was anticipating a diet pill. The other, Dr. Erickson, was anticipating a biological weapon. Answer. No. Question. Would it shock you, Dr. Erickson, to discover that I have in my possession correspondence between Dr. Edgerton and the CEO of TNO Prince Moritz discussing this very thing? Answer. That would shock me a great deal, sir. Question. Do you see how such a creature could, in certain engagements, be an ideal method of warfare, setting ethics and humanity aside, of course? Answer. I suppose I do. Question. It would be traceless. It would spread rapidly. An eyedropper full into a public reservoir would do it, yes? Answer. Oh, Jesus. Oh, God. Question. It could tear a country apart in short order, yes? Cause mass hysteria, destabilization, rampant infection, riots, fear, rage, secondary bloodshed in any order. It would defy both the letter and intent of the Geneva Convention, but it's just a hyper-virulent worm, yes? Nobody knows how it came to be. Mother Nature once again works her strange wonders to behold, yes? Answer. I had no idea. You have to believe me. Question. Dr. Erickson, I am under no obligation to do any such thing. That particular question of belief is up to this court to decide.
Chapter 37. Shelley waited until Max and Newton went down to the beach before climbing out of the cellar. The gauzy afternoon light stabbed his eyes like cocktail swords. The dark suited him now. Last night he'd lain in the cellar and dreamed of darkness slipping over the world. A forgiving dark. You could do things in that kind of blackness and get away with it. Nobody would ever see you. They would only feel you, and you could feel them.
Shelley found Ephraim lying on the picnic table. The sight was a pleasant one. It meant his game was progressing nicely. In fact, it appeared to have entered the endgame stage. Shelley swayed lightly on his feet with a dreamy look on his face. "Nobody loves me," he warbled. "Everybody hates me." He ran a finger down the gash on Ephraim's face. When the boy didn't stir, he pushed the tip of his finger into it. His nail broke the gummy glue of blood. His finger moved inside the wound. He pushed harder, grunting lightly. His fingertip went through Ephraim's cheek into his mouth. For a thrilling instant, he felt the smooth enamel of his teeth. Ephraim's eyelids cracked open. Shelley withdrew his finger. It came out with a gooey sound, like pulling your finger out of a pot of wallpaper paste.
"Shell, you don't look so hot."
Shelley supposed he didn't. At some point last night, he'd crept out of the cellar to eat the long timothy grass growing around the cabin, down on all fours like a cow at its cud. This morning, he'd chased a plump pigeon along the beach, screaming and frothing at the mouth. The foam falling from his lips was white, tinted with green from the grass. It looked like the spume that washed up on the North Point jetty. He hadn't caught the pigeon, but later he'd fallen asleep and dreamed that he had. In the dream, he'd torn its feathered head off, but not before eating the black jewels of its eyes as it struggled frantically in his hands, laughing and hissing as the bird's head separated from its body. He'd awoken to find his belly swollen to match his dream. The skin was pocked with lumps that looked like fledgling anthills.
"You saw it, didn't you?" Shelley asked Dolly.
"The worm." Shelley noticed the yellowish tinge to Ephraim's eyes. It was as if the oily madness in his brain had leached into his corneas. Ephraim's upper lip quivered. His chin went dimply as a golf ball.
"It's still inside me, Shell."
"Is that so?
Can't you fucking see, man? Can't you see it?"
The pleading note in Ephraim's voice was auditory honey sliding into Shelley's ears. He furrowed his brow and stared intently at Ephraim. Then he drew back suddenly, his head swept side to side, a sad and solemn gesture.
"I'm afraid so. It's still there. Didn't you do as I said?"
Ephraim's mouth twisted into a furious snarl. It was quickly replaced by a scrawl of breathless panic.
"I tried. I did exactly what you said. You got to get it out." "Why couldn't you do that?"
Twisting the knife in a person's psyche was nearly as much fun as twisting it in living flesh, Shelley had found.
"Is it because you're weak, like everyone says?"
Ephraim wept silently, clutching at Shelley.
"I can't do it. It's sneaky."
Leaning to one side, he spat a reeking sack of blood onto the grass.
"Can't. I can't."
Shelley's expression remained placid, hesitant even, but a mad light capered behind his eyes.
"Want me to get it for you? Do you have your knife?"
Shelley nodded.
"Of course."
He had a buck knife with a 5-inch blade, an inch and a half longer than the scout's official limit.
"Do you really see it, Shell, the worm?"
After a beat, Shelley said,
"I saw it, Eve. It was in the back of your eyes for a moment, a ripply thread behind the whites."
Ephraim made the most wretched, delightful sound Shelley had ever heard.
"You've got to get it out of me. I can't stand it." "Okay, Eve."
Shelley smiled, a happy camper. His teeth looked much bigger now with the gums peeling back.
"But first, you have to say one thing."
"What?"
"You have to say please."
"Please,"
Ephraim clutched at the hem of Shelley's pants, squealing.
"Please."
Shelley stifled his giggles. They built in his stomach like effervescent soda bubbles, rising up his throat in a hysterical wave. He didn't find any of this genuinely funny. Not at all. Ephraim had offered him a rare gift, the rarest. It took so much to penetrate the senseless jelly that enrobed Shelley's brain, took so much to make him feel. But now he was feeling so, so much. Needles of light streamed across his vision, unearthly and pure like a rift into heaven. He snapped the blade of his buck knife into position. I'll do it, but only because we're friends. A look of pitiful gratefulness came over Ephraim's face. Yes, he breathed. Get it out. Shelley's eyes cut down to the beach. No sign of Newt or Max. He'd sharpened the knife the night before their trip. He was scrupulous about such matters. You could split a doll's hair with the blade. Split it into thirds. He brought it down to Ephraim's face. He circled the tip around his earlobe and up around the teacup handle of his ear. The skin broke easily, just the first layer of epidermis. Blood teared up along the cut. Do you see it there? Ephraim asked. Shelley said, In your ear, yes. It poked out for a second. I saw it wriggling. Ephraim's fingers whitened around the table's edges. Oh, God. Please, Shell, I can't stand to have it in me. Mm-hmm, Shelley said, casually flirting the blade around the basin of Ephraim's ear. The steel tip brushed the microscopic hairs guarding his inner ear. Turn your head, he said sternly. I need to see down. Ephraim shifted onto his side. His eyes stared glassily at Shelley's swollen belly. A few buttons had popped off Shelley's shirt. Ephraim could see his lumped-up flesh through the vent. The inflamed anthills seemed to be twitching and breathing. Shelley gripped Ephraim's jaw with his free hand. How would it feel to sink the knife into Ephraim's ear? Would he encounter resistance, or would it be like stabbing a brick of cold butter? He pictured Ephraim staggering up with the knife hilt protruding from his ear, his smile beatific as he screamed, Did you get it? Did you? Did you? Instead, he idly slid the knife up Ephraim's head into his thick hairline. The flesh opened up as if by magic. A pair of red lips cut through the dark mane. Shelley thought of Moses parting the Red Sea. In the middle of the incision, he could see a vein-threaded rift of skull bone. Endorphins rushed through Shelley's system, lighting his neurons up like a pinball machine. Ephraim didn't cry out. Instead, he trembled with an outrush of powerful emotion and whispered, thank you so much. Shelley hacked a half moon into Ephraim's head. Blood of shockingly vibrant red sheeted down the boy's face. Thank you, he kept mumbling with pathetic gratefulness as the blood bubbled over his lips. Do you see it? Oh, please find it. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Shelley was remotely disgusted by Ephraim's behavior, but also fascinated. Ephraim's psychosis had some weird narcotizing effect. He wondered, if he cut around Ephraim's head until he hit the initial incision, could he tear his scalp off, just like the Indians used to do? If so, would Ephraim even care? The notion that he could be here for hours, hacking into a willing victim, sectioning Ephraim apart piece by piece, was thrilling in the extreme. And if things kept swinging his way, he wouldn't have to dispose of the body as he'd done with Trixie. Once he'd relished Ephraim's death, extracted from him the secrets Kent had withheld, and once Max and Newton were dead too, a task he foresaw as daunting but still achievable, once they were all dead, Shelley would have their bodies all to himself. He could arrange them around the fire, posing their limbs and thumbing their stiffening faces into expressions he couldn't quite comprehend, playing with the blood that wept like treacle from their wounds. Or he could cut them to pieces and reorganize them, different heads on different bodies, insulting them in death by disgracing their corpses, which would be funny, terribly funny, so funny that the giggle started to rise in his throat again. Afterward, he could leave them to the insects. Their bodies would become shelter and nourishment for beetles and slugs and worms. Yes, they'd be worm food. But Shelley had to be careful. The other two would soon return. Shelley thought he could hear their voices near the fire pit. He bit his lip, thinking. Finally, he said, "Wait here, Eve. I'll be right back." He shambled around to the generator, rocking it to see if any gas was left. There was. He descended into the cellar and found an empty mason jar. Then he popped the valve on the generator and drained gasoline into the jar. He returned to Ephraim and said, "I can't cut it out, Eve. It's too sneaky. The only way to get it is to burn it out." Ephraim's eyes were very white and wide in the bloody mask of his face. Shelley's words came to him as a revelation. They were the most sensible words anyone had ever spoken. Fire purifies all. Shelley set the jar next to him. "Burn it out, Ephraim. It's the only way, my friend." Shelley touched Ephraim's twitching face with great tenderness. "You know that, don't you? You're my very best friend." Ephraim swallowed. For a moment, it seemed he would bat Shelley's grub-like fingers away, but they dropped of their own accord. Shelley handed Ephraim his barbecue lighter. "That's okay," Ephraim said, pulling out his Zippo. "I've got my own." Ephraim picked up the jar and held it over his head. It hung there a moment. His face shuddered as if under the pressure of deep internal forces. Then it went slack. "Thank you, Shelley," he said. "You're the only one who gets it." Ephraim's hand tipped downward to saturate his flesh with gasoline. Chapter 38. By the time Newton and Max ran back to the cabin, Ephraim was on fire. A towering cone of flame enveloped the body of a boy who suddenly looked small, shrunken, and trapped within it. They bolted into the clearing only to check up by degrees, their feet lagging like cars lolling to an awkward stall. Their horror inspired inertness. Ephraim was on fire. A swiftly charring effigy. Their minds collectively yammered at them to do something, but dear God, what could they do? The idea of shouting at him to stop, drop, and roll seemed quaintly absurd. The flames swept up from Ephraim's shoulders in orange wings. He was glowing and ephemeral. He might lift off the ground like an ember swirling up from an open fire. His flame-robed arms oared in lopsided circles. The sound of his legs scissoring the air was like sheets of very fine silk being ripped apart. Horribly, Max could see that he was inhaling the fire. Flames were crawling down into his lungs, igniting them. Ephraim crumpled to the ground. His legs kept kicking as if he were trying to step over a low obstacle. When they finally acted, it was too late. Had it ever not been too late? Max dashed into the cabin, heedless of the men lying dead inside, grabbed a sleeping bag, ran back, and dropped it over Ephraim where he lay curled in a thatch of crabgrass. Plumes of meaty smoke drifted around the bag's edges. One of Ephraim's feet jutted from under the bag. The soles of his boots had fused into a smooth black sheen that resembled a slick drag racing tire. A single point of flame danced on the tip of his boot. When Max pulled the sleeping bag back, it was obvious at first glance that Ephraim was dead. The heat had curled his body up like when you toss a cellophane packet into a fire. His thighs were tucked tight to his chest like a child in the fetal position. His kneecaps appeared to be heat welded to his forehead. His clothes were either burned off or fused through grisly alchemical processes to his skin. He was charred all over like something left too long in the oven. His features were erased the same way a mannequin's would be if someone had taken a blowtorch to its head.
"Oh, Jesus," Newton said. "Oh, Eve, Eve."
Merciless bands of iron clapped around Max's chest. His breath came in shallow, jaggedy bursts. The shock was such that he could only stare at the body, coring a hole into it with his eyes.
"Where the hell's Shelley?" Max said.
Max's left eyelid developed a weird tick. The muscles kept clenching and releasing. It looked like he was trying to wink, but couldn't quite get his face to cooperate. He felt the anger boiling out of him, which was how he figured it must always happen. pressure turned fear into rage as surely as pressure turns coal into a diamond. Fear was an internal emotion. It got trapped inside of you. You had to let it out. For that, you turned to rage, the ultimate external emotion. All rage ever needed was something to focus on. Was this how Eve had gone through life, fighting this rage that was a kissing cousin to pure madness? Shelley rounded the cabin. Seeing him, Max's chest hitched in sudden shock. Hick! Max thought Shelley looked as if someone had located a hidden zipper down his back, tugged it down, and skinned 30-odd pounds of meat from his bones before zippering the sagging shell back up again. He couldn't help but notice the blood on his hands. "Hey, guys," Shelley waved chummily. The tone of his voice was faintly mocking. "You," Max leveled a finger at Shelley. "Where were you?"
"No place special."
Shelley's gaze fell upon Ephraim. If he exhibited any emotion at all, it was dry revulsion, the look a passing motorist might give roadkill.
"Where the fuck?"
Max said, his words coming out in great, livid gasps. "Were you?" Shelley shrugged with his hands in his pockets, a carefree, maddening gesture. Huge boils the size of cherry bombs throbbed on his neck where his adenoid should have been.
"Stay away from him," Newt whispered to Max. "He's sick with it."
But Max's rage was all-consuming. The reek of gasoline wafted off Shelley. He'd done something.
"What did you do, Shell?"
Max thought, what did any of them really know about Shelley? He was a lanky, furtive boy who kept to himself with an inner intensity of evasion and secrecy. The other boys tolerated him, but nobody would call him a friend. They didn't make sport of him, not because he wasn't mockable with his thick-lipped vacancy and stunned inability to comprehend the simplest jokes.
"Stay away from him," Newt told Max a little louder.
Max continued to advance. He'd never really been in a fight. Eve got into scraps all the time. He was good at it, too. He was fearless. Had been fearless.
Oh, Jesus.
This felt like more than a fight to Max. The acid boiling through his veins told him so. He reached for Shelley. He'd wrap his hands round his throat and squeeze until his windpipe collapsed. There were no adults to tell him no. Besides, who says an adult wouldn't act just the same? One of Shelley's hands released from his pocket. A quick silver flash. Next, pain was sizzling along Max's sternum just above his hip bones. Both boys stared down. An inch of Shelley's buckknife was inserted into Max's abdomen. Max stared at it quizzically, his dizzied mind thinking, "Now, that doesn't belong there." The strangest thing in the world, being stabbed. Had he even been stabbed, or had Shelley simply held the knife out defensively and let Max impale himself on the blade? He glanced at Shelley with a panicky grin that showed too many of his teeth. It was a grin that said, "This was an accident, right? Things haven't gotten that bad, have they?" But Max saw the rancid emptiness in Shelley's eyes and saw his own cheese-white reflection in Shelley's dilated pupils and knew that yes, yes, things had gotten this bad. Shelley's arm flexed stealthily. Max pulled away, but still a half inch of the blade divided the red sheets of muscle. Shelley's expression was impassive, marginally curious. He could have been carving a roast or dissecting a pickled pig in science class. A stick of wood whistled down and struck Shelley on the back of his skull. It landed with a solid whack, the sound of a baseball struck with the sweet spot of a bat. The knife slipped from Shelley's hands. His knees buckled. His eyes rolled back so far in his skull that Max saw the quivering whites. The wood slipped from Newton's trembling hands.
"I had to," he said. "He was gonna kill you, Max."
Chapter 39. Shelley staggered up. A goose egg swelled on the back of his head. It was so huge that it stretched the hairs on his scalp apart to reveal the vein-snaked skin.
A crazed, curdled light shone in the pit of each iris. He took a step forward, swooned like a man on the deck of a storm-tossed ship before falling down on his ass. He laughed, a thin, warbling titter that tapered to a drone. "I'll kill you," he said between volleys of laughter. There was no real menace in his voice. He could have been stating a matter of his daily agenda. "Kill you both,"